Welcome to the Back 9 Report, presented by eDraft.com.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Back 9 Report presented by eDraft.com. We go live every Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, checking on the world of golf to bring you the latest news, insights, analysis, interviews. Hey, we cover anything and everything golf. My name is Carlos Torres. Every week, I'm alongside my co-host Fred Alvader. Fred, I don't know how Jordan Spieth is feeling. I am so tired after that. I don't know how he's feeling.
What a finish to the U.S. Open, Carlos. I was glued to the set all weekend, as you know, because we were texting back and forth. Unbelievable course. And, you know, Jordan Spieth wins his second consecutive major championship. He's going to be playing in the Open Chip at St. Andrews. That's going to be a cakewalk for Spieth after surviving treacherous Chambers Bay. We have a great guest interview with 2014 PGA Teacher of the Year, Kathy Gildersleeve Jensen, tonight. Carlos, I'm excited. We got a lot to cover. Let's go.
We have a lot to talk about, and we're going to start on the weekend backswing with what else? The U.S. Open. You know, it was just over a year ago. Jordan Spieth, he broke onto the scene when he finished runner-up to Bubba Watson at the 2014 Masters, but now he's 21-year-old, and he's a household name in golf. The world's second-ranked player and a two-time major champion after a shocking turn of events on Sunday. He was playing in the penultimate group, and he broke off a tie for first place with that two-putt birdie on the 72nd hole, Chambers Bay, and then watched Dustin Johnson three-putt from 12 feet for par, giving him the U.S. Open title. But, you know, he had quite a day that saw him trailing by two strokes to Johnson through 10 holes. Combined with three bogeys in four holes from Johnson, Spieth then birdied 12 and then later rolled in a huge 27-foot bending birdie putt on 16. That blew him up three shots with two to play after playing partner Brandon Grace, who was tied for the lead, double bogey that same hole. And just when it seemed like Spieth was going to run away with things, oh, my God. He three-putted for double bogey at a par 3-17th and dropped back into a tie for the lead with Louis Oosthuizen, who rallied with six birdies over his final seven holes. And with Spieth in the 18th fairway, then Johnson stuck his shot to 6 feet on the 17th and made that for a birdie to tie the lead. Spieth knocked his second shot at the par 5 last to 16 feet and two-putted for birdie to take the lead. Now all he could do was watch and wait. Johnson also hit the green in two and was 4 feet closer, and at least an 18-hole playoff on Monday seemed imminent. However, Johnson rolled his eagle putt for the win 3 feet past the hole and then missed in ensuing birdie effort to tie to the left, giving title to Spieth. You know, this was somehow, I don't know, some new territory for Spieth, as his first major title at the Masters in April came with relative ease. He cruised to wire-to-wire four-chip victory then to win the green jacket, and now after this, he's the owner of the U.S. Open trophy. With that win, he became the sixth player ever, and the first since Tiger Woods in 2002 to win the Masters and the U.S. Open in the same season. Spieth is also the youngest to capture these two championships. Fred, when it's all said and done, Spieth will realize that he's already halfway to the career Grand Slam, and a feat that only five golfers have achieved. None of them is Phil Mickelson, which we all picked to win.
Yeah, but you know what? He's not only halfway to a career Grand Slam. He's halfway to a real Grand Slam. And if he would happen to win at the Open Championship, holy moly, poor kid, he'll be descended upon by the media. He won't have a free minute. But, hey, Carlos, I want to just touch base on the top storylines for me, which there were an abundance of, and I have to limit it to just the very best. Let's start talking about that spectacular finish that you just talked about. For a 21-year-old to collect himself after making that atrocious double bogey at the 71st hole after Brandon Grace had basically handed him the golf tournament, he immediately tuned out that double and focused on making a birdie or eagle at the last to stay in the tournament. That, to me, describes the greatness of Jordan Spieth. Have you seen his numbers this year? In 17 events, he has 10 top 10 finishes, 3 wins, including the 2 majors, 3 runners-up, and a third. He has won nearly $8 million with the Bridgestone, 2 majors, and the FedEx Cup still to go. He could win over $20 million in prize money this year. He drew a little closer to Rory for the number one and increased his lead in the PGA Tour money list and the FedEx Cup points list. He is having a, dare I say, a Tiger-esque-like year. Second storyline, Carlos, the three-putt of Dustin Johnson, which everyone is bemoaning, at the 72nd hole to give Spieth the win, well, that was unfortunate. But his real problems were his bogeys he made at 10, 11, and 13. They were the culprits for his demise because he lost his confidence on the greens and started waving at putts rather than stroking them. Those shaggy fescue greens ate up any ball that didn't have a true roll on it. Look at what Oosthuizen, Rory, Adam Scott, and Brant Snedeker were able to do when they got more aggressive on the greens and really started putting some meat on those rolls. Speaking of Louis Oosthuizen, his back 929 on Sunday included 6 birdies and 3 pars, and as you said, 6 birds in the last 7 holes. What a round. That is exactly what is possible on that final 9 holes, and that is why the USGA will return to Chambers Bay. The back 9 there has more thrills and chills than any amusement park roller coaster. Fourth point, Brant Snedeker, Adam Scott, and Rory McIlroy all finished with very good rounds on Sunday. The stage was set. The guys out early had great rounds, and they got the crowd going. They got the fans involved and watching. I thought Rory had it. I thought he really had it going after he made that 70-foot putt early in on this back nine. But then 2 bogeys at the end pushed him back down the leaderboard. He really looked good on the front nine. How about a shout-out to the 21-year-old second-year pro from Australia, Cameron Smith. Shot rounds of 70, 70, 69, 68, kept getting better. Outstanding stuff for his PGA Tour debut. He earned special temporary PGA Tour membership along with Shane Lowry and Brandon Grace. Jason Day's performance while battling vertigo was simply outstanding. He fell to the ground walking down the steep slope after hitting his tee shot on the par 3 ninth hole during the second round on Friday. Unbelievable stuff. You could see he struggled even to walk on the weekend. How could he get his eyes to focus and putt is just a mystery to me. And congrats to the 6 amateurs that made the cut at Chambers Bay. Brian Campbell was low am for a T27. Denny McCarthy and Oliver Schneiderhans, who's ranked number one amateur in the world, tied at T42. Nick Hardy was a T52, and Bo Hostler and Jack McGuire ended up tied for 58th. 2 caddies were even injured when they fell on the slopes around the golf course. That was the talk early in the week, how dangerous it was to even trek around there. And finally, Gary Player's 6-minute rant on Golf Channel about the USGA, Robert Trent Jones, and Chambers Bay was totally classless, Carlos. Very uncharacteristic of one of the game's great gentlemen. I'm going to cover Fox's ineptitude in a few minutes, but what the USGA did to a beautiful golf course like Chambers Bay is inexcusable. They did not have to turn the water off completely, Carlos. There was another tournament last week, as you mentioned. I want to say 17-year-old Brooke Henderson, who is so close to earning her LPGA Tour card for next season, won on the Symetra Tour this week in South Bend. She has made her mission to make the big tour without going to Q School this fall, and I would not bet against her. She's finishing top 10 on the Symetra Tour at the end of the season will earn her a tour card if she does not finish inside the top 40 on the LPGA Tour money list. She earned $22,000 for her 3-shot win at the Four Winds Invitational, which moves her inside the top 15 on the money list on the Symetra Tour, and she secures membership to that tour also, Carlos. So she is on a mission.
Oh, she is, and let me tell you, she became the third youngest winner in Sorrento Tour history. After the victory, LPGA Tour Commissioner Mike Wann accepted her waiver petition for the Sorrento Tour membership before the age of 18. Last year, Wann had denied Henderson the LPGA Tour age petition, preventing her from playing Q School. She's going to be 18 on September 10th. And, you know, she has played in 7 LPGA Tour events this season, finishing inside the top 5 in 2 of them, including last week in the Women's PGA Championship. That is a player to be watching. And also there were 2 other minor tours there, the Ladies European Tour, 27-year-old Christian Bolchon. She rolled a 4-stroke win in the Deloitte Ladies Open for her 4th win on the Ladies European Tour. And just checking here, you know, I just saw that in the web.com tour, Shane Burch, he won there the Rothalium Championship at Lakewood Country Club, picked up his 3rd career victory on the web.com tour. Lucas Lee finished alone in 2nd, and I just saw here that Patton Kassir, you know, he ended up much further back, and he's still in the front. Kelly Kraft is still 3rd. I just checked on it. It was just checking up. Not that I was caring about that. You know, Patton Kassir is still a top. Anyway, let's take a very short break. And when we come back, we're going to have the Part 5 news presented by United Golf Network. Sorry about that.
Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to visit www.edraft.com for analysis, breaking news, and more. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter at edraftsports and on Facebook at facebook.com/edraftsports. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now it's time for the Part 5 News, sponsored by United Golf Network. And Fred, I'm going to call you Professor Fred. Can you hand out the grades for Fox News and the U.S. Open coverage crew?
I can, but they won't be very good, Carlos. Twitter and Facebook were just a buzz all weekend, all week really, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, with the Fox Sports and one and Fox coverage of the tournament. But Carlos, there is good news. The good news is that Fox recorded a 37% increase in viewership over NBC's coverage of the 2014 U.S. Open from Pinehurst. The first two rounds saw a 33% increase. I'm sorry. The first two rounds, there was a 37% increase, and then on the weekend, there was a 33% increase. They peaked at 5 million viewers on Saturday's third round broadcast in the 10 to 10:30 p.m. time slot. That says something, I think, about golfers in general. What? They got nothing better to do on a Saturday evening and sit at home and watch golf? Here's a very interesting stat for you. The broadcast showed significant ratings jump over 2014 across several key demographics. Men, 18 to 34, was up 75%. That's what they're trying to do, is draw young men back to the game of golf. You know, maybe Rory and Jordan and Ricky and some of these young guys are getting that job done. So a lot of young guys watched the tournament. Maybe they were in a bar drinking beer while they were doing it, chasing women, but there was a lot of young guys watching the tournament somewhere. I'm sure those excellent numbers had something to do with it being on the West Coast as it was aired in prime time here in the East. But I think many people tuned in just to see what missteps the bumbling Fox Sport crew would do next, kind of like watching a NASCAR race and waiting for the next big pileup. As we all know, Fox is in the first year of a billion-dollar contract with the USGA to air all USGA tournaments on their network. They had a test run at the men's and women's four-ball championships last month at Bandon Dunes, but this was the first big test for the A-team of Joe Buck, Greg Norman, Brad Faxon, Steve Flesch, Corey Pavin, Tom Weisskopf et al. Now to the bad news. Where to begin critiquing this group is as difficult as trying to make par on number 18 at Chambers Bay when it's converted to a par 4, like it was on Friday's second round. First of all, Julie Inkster and Holly Saunders have to have the best jobs on television. They get paid big bucks and don't have to do anything. What, they shaved their legs for this? What it, you know, their airtime was so limited that if you went to the refrigerator to restock your cold beverage, you missed them entirely. Julie Engster was completely MIA. I'm not even sure her microphone was on. Why in the world didn't Fox have more for Holly Saunders? She was one of the few people on the team that had any golf broadcasting experience whatsoever. She should have been in that booth instead of Kurt Menefee. I love Tom Weisskopf, but he seemed totally disengaged all weekend. His comments were dull and cliche. Let's talk Gil Hanse for a minute. With the Olympic golf course in Rio and Donald Trump's redesign of Durrell on his resume, he's one of the premier golf course designers in the world right now. His comments were on point and solid, but Fox should have gone to him more, especially when discussing a player's particular line into those difficult undulating greens. They did have some cool graphics like the split screen shot tracker, but they needed that because their cameramen couldn't find the ball in the air on the fairway, and their timing of what they chose to air was way off. The close-up shots of the ball rolling were annoying. Pan out, let's see where it was going. That gave me vertigo right there. Even with their cool little chase cam, they never got good views of awkward lies, and their on-course reporters, Jake Delsing and Julie, were seldom used. The views of Puget Sound, Mike Rainier, they were cool but overused. They could have also had some features on surrounding areas, Seattle, Portland even, or Tacoma. They're beautiful with a myriad of activities and attractions. In-studio anchor Kurt Menefee appeared to be totally out of his comfort zone, and the list of mistakes committed by production crew and technical support personnel is too long and arduous to get started. And I'm a novice at this stuff, Carlos, and I saw it. So this is only a 60-minute show. You're going to put me on mute if I keep going on. So let's just say that the rest of the Fox broadcast team, they definitely have a lot of room for improvement before the U.S. Women's Open in a couple of weeks at Lancaster Country Club outside of Philadelphia, Carlos. I wasn't too happy with the coverage. I'm not sure about you, but you couldn't tell. I don't know if you could tell that or not.
No, I could not tell that. Really, for what you said, no. I thought you really enjoyed it, but anyway.
I did enjoy it.
I enjoyed the players, not the coverage, but anyway. I think the record was, that race was because people were trying to find out what was going on in the U.S. Open, not because of the coverage, but anyway. You know, I have never been in labor. Okay, obviously, I'm a man, but after watching Tiger Woods playing on Thursday and Friday, you know, I was in such pain that I've never been before that I told myself, man, this must be like what it is to deliver a baby.
Oh my goodness, so painful.
Here are some of the highlights that I have for you. I mean, that was Tiger's worst ever U.S. Open round opener, an opening 10 over 80. I mean, a leaderboard stretch where only the great Rich Berbarian Jr., a club pro, was lower than him. Tiger hitting his club some 20 yards behind him on a chop out of the hay, you know, I don't know why. Then he promptly finding the rough on the hole with the widest fairway in the history of the U.S. Open. I mean, how can he find it? I mean, did he have a GPS for that shot? It's incredible. And an ambiguous top into the ground and down the middle of the 18th fairway and into the worst bunker on the course.
That was the topper, wasn't it?
No, that's incredible. Fans audibly laughing at the shot, something you might see a regular weekend shop pull off at your local muni, you know. The road TV commentary lemons we get each time Tiger tees it up in 2015. Greg Norman said, hey, look, completely lost, completely drained, and was sad to watch. Corey Paving, who walked with Tiger's group, said, it's hard to watch. Yeah, I know. I was watching it. You know, a post-round media session, which he did not have to agree to, intensely watched and regulated to 5 questions by his representatives, who signal how many were left with a hand raised countdown with the fingers up to the side. You know, it's 4 more, 3 more, 2, you know. When the price tried to cram a couple of extra questions in, his reps barked at the USGA media relations person to get him out of there. That's incredible. Tiger is starting his second day with another opening bogey and a tumble of his, on his behind. That was funny. But it was the 10th time in his last 11 PGA Tour rounds that he has bogeyed his first hole. Members of the crowd, as he walked down his final hole, mercifully were shouting, "Go Tiger, we believe in you, and we love you," followed by one bold individual. I know you all heard him with a mocking bellow. "Need some weekend tickets, Tiger?" You know, that's it. Got quiet up on the green. But he struggled again on Friday, and this time he shot a 6 over 76, easily missed the cut with the worst score through two rounds of his professional career at 16 overs. So only Darren Clark had a worse 36 score when Woods finished his round. It was just 36 holes, but it was a full carnival package from the broadcast to the fans to his play on the course. And Spieth, playing just minutes ahead of him, accentuated it all. But, you know, in other news regarding him in 2012, Woods, Rory McIlroy, Justin Rose, Webb Simpson, Matt Kuchar, Lee Westwood, Hunter Mahan, and Charles Schwartzel all took part in a lucrative exhibition that was played the same weekend at the Fry's tournament, and that was in Turkey. The PGA Tour requires its members to get a release to play in events that conflict. In exchange for getting to play there in Turkey, the eight players were asked to play the Fry's tournament once over the following 3 years. This is the last year. So already Kuchar, Mahan, and Westwood have fulfilled their obligation. And although Woods had yet to formally announce it, a source was telling ESPN.com that he will make good on the commitment to Commissioner Tim Fincham and join Rory McIlroy, who has already committed to the event, as well as Justin Rose to play in the Fry's.com Open at the Silverado Country Club in Napa. That's going to be October 15th to the 18th. We'll see Tiger next at the Greenbrier Classic in 2 weeks. He'll go work in his patterns and baseline shifts with his swing consultant, Chris Como, but expect more of the same tough stuff in the hills of West Virginia in a couple of weeks. Hopefully by the time the Fry's.com Open comes, he would have figured out what's wrong with him and contend. So Fred's, you know, when Woods was at the 2011 event, the attendance was 75,000. They have averaged 40,000. But this year, with the mere presence of Rory, Tiger in any shape or form, and Rose expect record crowds.
You know, Tiger is in such a bad place right now, I don't even think Rene Russo from Tin Cup could help him get straightened out. Did you see that in the first round when he and Ricky Fowler and Louis Oosthuizen were paired together, the three of them were 28 over par. Louis turned around and he played well and finished runner up, you know, but he played really strong the last 3 days. But they were pretty ugly. Thank goodness Louis got away from those two guys and could play. Hey, this next story comes under the heading Lydia Ko's career is clearly over. Thus far in 2015, Lydia Ko has 2 wins, 7 top 10 finishes, and held the number one ranking in the world for several weeks. She misses a cut at the KPMG Women's PGA Championship, and you would think the sky is falling. Chris Ratu, a writer for the New Zealand Herald, has even gone so far as to offer suggestions for Ko to get her golf career back on track. Wonder how many professional golf tournaments Mr. Ratu has won in his journalistic career. Here's a quote from his column. Ko's career has exceeded expectations on one hand and fallen short on another. Her rise to become the game's youngest number one was extraordinary, but she was supposed to have won a major by now. He does realize she just turned 18, right? She was a top-ranked woman amateur for 3 years prior to joining the professional ranks and was ranked number 4 in the world when she did turn pro in October of 2013. And, by the way, she had 2 LPGA Tour wins and 3 other wins in professional tournaments while still an amateur, all before the age of 18. She's added 5 more LPGA Tour titles and a slew of top 10 finishes. She is adjusting to moving to Florida and traveling on professional tour when she should be worrying about who's going to take her to the prom and picking out a perfect dress. He thinks she should be winning majors like Jordan Spieth. He does make a reasonable point that Ko, who split with her longtime coach, New Zealander Gary Wilson, and switched to the David Ledbetter stable, may not be entirely on board with everything they want her to work on. But give her a break. First of all, there's nothing wrong with Lydia Ko. She's just fine. Thank you very much. We heard in our interview with her last week just what a mature and confident young woman she is. She possesses one of the best all-round golf games in the world, and on top of all that, she has the mental strength and unflappability of a much older person. Leave her alone. She's just fine. She will win majors, Carlos. You can mark it down. I set it today, June 23rd, 2015.
I'll back you up on that one. I'll second that one. So, yeah, mark it down. She will. Hey, you know, for those who have arrived, who arrive at the birthplace of golf on a sunny Sunday morning, the rules to play are simple. You can pretty much do anything you want on the historic grounds there of the old course, as long as it does not involve actually hitting a drive or wrapping a pot. Frisbees are fine. Picnics, too. Locals might tell you that pushing a baby stroller or pram in the vernacular can get a little challenging in some of the more uneven parts of the course. But if your little one will be soothed by the strong winds whipping in from the North Sea, well, so be it. Wedding photos on the famed Swilcan Bridge are no problem, either. Though guests in formal attire should be advised that they're not fitting with the more casual university students who like to bowl about in the 18th fairway. Simply put, all are welcome at the home of golf on Sundays, except golfers. So in a city where good weather means it rained for only half a day, and a course that most every golfer in the world would dearly love to play, why would anyone think it's a good idea to close on a weekend? It beats me. I don't know. That's some heard back here in America. But historians trace the old course Sunday closure to religious laws dating at least to the 16th century, when some residents of St. Andrews were cited in town criminal logs for playing on the Sabbath. According to
Golf
Gordon
is
Moore,
it's a devil's tool, Carlos. Golf is a devil's tool.
I tell you, and I have something else that I'm going to talk to her about in the final putts that you'll see why it's that way. But anyway, the director of the greens keeping there at St. Andrews, Gordon Moore, it was not until 1941 that the other courses at the complex were open for playing on Sundays. As with many regulations from a different era, the Sunday slumber for the old course is a rule that is simultaneously charming and maddening. For most purists, that would be a group that seems to include the majority of the residents of this town on Scotland's east coast. The centuries-old edict to refrain from golf on Sundays is a sacred part of the old course veneration traditions. For many golfing tourists, that would be a group that has only been more feverish this year ahead of the next month's British Open at the old course. That is right down cruel. But there has never been any serious discussion about changing the Sunday rule, and even old Tom Morris is believed to have said and have preached, even if the golfers don't need a rest, the course does. Sundays are a chance to tackle the more intensive labor repairs and get a full reading on what the course needs. The course is closed to the public, golfers and picnickers alike, since last Friday to prepare for the British Open. There are, of course, some exceptions to the Sunday rest. Practice rounds for the British Open, for example, are scheduled to begin on July 12, which is a Sunday, and play will naturally be allowed on the next weekend when the final round is played on July 19, also a Sunday. There are also a few other tournaments throughout the year when Sunday is permitted. But Fred, St. Andrews will be the site of the next men's major championship, where Jordan Spieth will try to make it 3-for-3 in 2015. And while the rest of the world of golf is on the first tee at dawn or trapezing through a six-hour round at packed municipal courses on Sunday, you know, the birthplace of it all stays quiet.
That is a really cool tradition, Carlos. I learned of that a few years ago, and I applaud them for maintaining that. The people there, I mean, it's owned by the town, but just think of how much income they're giving up by closing it one day a week. You know, that place generates a lot of income for that town. So a really cool tradition. Carlos, 2015 has been a really good year for the Nicklaus family. Jack was honored by the Congress with the Congressional Gold Medal, and he was given his own room at USGA's Far Hills Museum in May. They donate millions each year to their pet loves of Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus and the Nicklaus Hospital in Miami. Jack is not the only one being recognized this time, however. Barbara Nicklaus received the Bobby Jones Award from the USGA last week during the U.S. Open at Tacoma. The Bob Jones Award is the USGA's highest honor, and in a statement from the USGA, President Tom O'Toole said, Barbara's generosity of spirit and deep respect for the game have touched the lives of countless families throughout the world. Her dedication to support players and spouses and advocacy for multiple causes are worthy of our highest honor. Junior golf programs across the nation and children's health initiatives in South Florida benefited from the Nicklaus largesse. Jack and Barbara pledged $60 million to the Miami Children's Health Initiative, a gift funneled through their Nicklaus Children's Health Care Foundation, and the memorial annually generates millions of dollars for the Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus. The main impetus that prompted the Nicklauses to become so involved with the children's health issues came after a scare with one of their five children. Their daughter inhaled a part of a crayon when she was just 11 months old. A piece entered her lung and necessitated a stay at Columbus Children's Hospital. Barbara Nicklaus said the doctors and nurses there saved their daughter's life. Jack continuously credits Barbara with getting him involved in their charitable aspect of their endeavors. He saw the passion and the enjoyment that she received from working with the children at the hospitals and became more involved as time went along. Even though Jack is revered for his commitment to family issues, it was Barbara that bore much of the parenting duties while Jack was traveling the world winning golf tournaments. It was Barbara that got the Nicklaus family involved in providing millions of dollars for all the children's charity. It was Barbara that seemingly was always there to offer help and advice to other tour wives when they needed a steady head to guide them through the difficult waters of a tour wife. You know what they say, Carlos, behind every successful man is a woman that made him that way. So congratulations to Barbara Nicklaus, the woman behind the man, for this wonderful recognition and award of her very own. And, Carlos, that wraps up the Par 5 News presented by United Golf Network for June 23, 2015. United Golf Network wants every golfer to enjoy the game more and have the opportunity to earn money while doing it. They offer a top line of golf products, including popular name brands like Nike, Wilson, Greg Norman, Ashworth, TaylorMade, Adidas, and Where to Win. Everything a golfer needs, clubs, balls, bags, shoes, apparel, and accessories are available with discount coupons for huge savings. United Golf Network not only has an excellent product line, they also offer every golf nut the chance to earn commissions on products through their director's program. United Golf Network provides instant and free access to Global Affinity, which offers discounted travel through Wyndham Endless Vacations. Another free perk is membership to My Golf in U.S., which offers discounted rounds of golf in 16 states and 3 Canadian provinces. Plus, For Sale by Owner allows members to sell used or new equipment online. Visit UnitedGolfNetwork.com today and check out the products, discounts, and their opportunity, Carlos.
And remember, United Golf Network was created by entrepreneurs to give golfers the opportunity to play golf, make money, and enjoy life. That wraps up our Par 5 News presented by United Golf Network. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to have our VIG, very important guest of the week. She's Kathy Gildersleeve Jensen. Don't go away.
Thank you for listening to the Back Nine Report presented by eDraft.com. We'll be right back. Don't forget to check out our co-hosts on Twitter by clicking their names in the episode description. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now it's time for the very important guest, the VIG of the week. Her name is Kathy Gildersleeve Jensen. She's the Director of Golf Instruction at Indian Canyon Golf Course in Spokane, Washington, and she's also the 2014 PGA Teacher of the Year, who was at Chambers Bay all weekend. She will give us her perspective on it on this interview that Fred had with her. So, Fred, set up this interview for us.
Yeah, Carlos, I wanted to have 2014 PGA Teacher of the Year, Kathy Gildersleeve Jensen, on the show for some time, and we have never been able to work out the details. Well, we finally were able to set it up. She lives in Spokane, Washington, and spent some time at Chambers Bay last week. She provides insight into the U.S. Open as well as talks about her teaching and a book that she has written. So, Carlos, I found it quite interesting. Love talking to her. So go ahead and play it if you would.
We are very happy to have Kathy Gildersleeve-Jensen, a PGA teaching professional from Spokane, Washington. She works at the Indian Canyon Golf Course. She's received a ton of awards for her teaching prowess over the years and was named PGA Teacher of the Year in 2014. She published a book, How to Play Golf Inside 50 Yards, which is available on Amazon, should you like to pick that up. And, Kathy, we're so honored to have you here on Back Nine Report talking to us today.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me, Fred. I'm very excited to chat with you on golf and anything related to golf, especially this week, too. So, yes, very good.
Hey, you got to spend a couple of days at Chambers Bay watching the U.S. Open last week. Can you give us a couple of the highlights and kind of maybe what stood out for you at the tournament?
Well, I went over there to go view it because it's in my backyard. I live on the other side of the state of Washington, but for us to go over there was interesting. I have a whole bunch of clients and other golf professionals that went, and we were very excited to have it over here in the Pacific Northwest. And whether it was controversial or not, it was a very viewed, probably one of the interesting U.S. Opens probably in history, and the outcome of it was phenomenal. Yeah, it was very hard to walk, though. I think that's I think if you were walking down the fairway, it would have been a lot easier. But that's why they put the big grandstands there, because it would be more convenient for the spectators to watch. The views were outstanding as well.
Yeah, there was probably more hype surrounding this golf course, the design of Robert Trent Jones, and the setup that the USGA used for this golf course in just about any Open that's ever been contested. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. And it's kind of out of the – it's a different links than we're used to up here in the Pacific Northwest. You have a lot of Douglas firs, and we're usually surrounded by trees, and my course is. I mean, you have to hit it straight or else you're in the trees. So this one doesn't have – but it only has one, and it's very links and very undulating. I thought the undulation was it's very extreme undulations. And it was very – I'm sure it took a lot more energy from the pros themselves to get beyond that.
Yeah, I really felt that it was going to be a younger guy's tournament. Amazing to me that Jason Day, fighting illness or vertigo, that he could even get around that place, because the elevation change there is – I'm tired just walking 9 holes. And, that place is like mountain Chambers Bay is like mountains compared to hills, little hills at Augusta National.
Absolutely. And Jason Day, to get through that is pure just – trying to do whatever he can do to make that happen was remarkable on his part of it. I was stunned because it is quite the hike, and it's quite the different changes for him to go through that.
Well, I know
kudos
you've seen the course.
Him,
yeah, it was amazing. His effort was unbelievable. And I know you've seen the course when there's actually been some grass on it and they've watered it a little bit. What was your take on USGA setup, how dry, how firm and fast that they had it?
Well, there's two different kinds of grasses, and the fescue, it's kind of a golden brown color anyway, and it doesn't require a lot of water, and so it looks more dead than it is. We're used to seeing green grass, and it was more of an to preserve water is their take on it when they did that. But also the poana grass is kind of a weed, and it's a seedy kind of weed, and it thrives on water. So you get two different colors. It looks spotty, and they're two different grasses. One's kind of fuller, and one's kind of like a really thin blade type idea. So it will create bumps, and it's just interesting. And it's hard to get rid of poa. It's just a, we have it all over all of our golf courses over here. And once it gets on some golf shoes, it spreads. So if you get some on your golf shoes and take it to another course, you get Poana. And so that's kind of how it's a hard one to get rid of. And so it creates some bumpy motions, and the fescue is kind of a lay down kind of a grass that you can really clip really fine. So they got some gullies and bumps because of those two kind of different grasses.
In my
take of it, sometimes if it was just all Poana, that would probably have been better.
What did you think about some of the bounces? The golf course is so firm. Some of the bounces going into those greens and the way the greens sloped off, bunkers are falling into, kind of some severe lies around the greens, almost bordered on unfair at times.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of more they had to play a lot of bank shots, kind of like in billiards. They had to bank it in all the time. They had to go to a high slope so it would come down. It wasn't like they were always thinking about how to, where was the bank and can I go to that end of it. It wasn't more like target golf like we're used to. They really had to do some special thinking and be very meticulous about where they were going to place that ball so it would come in, and if they missed it, it was going to be into another bunker. I thought there would be more conversations on the bunkers. I thought they were very, very. I was in there doing a video shoot on their sand, and the sand is a native sand. It's kind of oily looking color, but they got out of that and no questions on that one. So I thought that was kind of interesting that they really talked about sand. It was more about the greens, but they were playing a lot of bank shots, whether they're hitting off the tees or down the fairways or. It was more of try to figure out this golf course rather than kind of figure out the targets.
Let me ask you one more question about the USM before we get away from that. You were there for a couple of days, walked down the course a little bit. We heard a lot of horror stories about twisted ankles and difficult to walk, difficult to see. What's your take on that as actually being there and walking on the course?
Well, the people that were spectating didn't go very far from the main area. They either stayed at 18 green or they really went over to 16 and 15 a lot because that was more on the lower end of the elevation. And so it was easier for people to walk that. But if they had to go to a different hole, it was harder to follow a group. So either we took binoculars and sat in the grandstands and we could see all the players, but we had binoculars. So if you didn't, it was, you were just kind of either in one location. You couldn't go around it. If you were going over to watch a player and you were on the sides of the fescue, it's pretty slick. I mean, even you saw Tiger Woods slip. I mean, that was just common. You saw people sliding all over the place sometimes. And if you weren't careful, and they had it roped off so the crowd could only go a certain place, but if you ventured off just a hair a little bit, you were on a steep, slippery slope.
That had to be a mountain goat to navigate there at times.
Yeah, exactly.
Tell us a little bit more about yourself. How did you originally get into teaching golf?
Well, I've been in the Pacific Northwest. I played golf for Oregon State. I grew up in a small town in eastern Oregon, in Baker, Oregon. I started when I was nine years old, and my parents got me right into it. I didn't grow up with a golf pro. My initial take, I wanted to go to a Billy Casper golf camp, get out and see what was out there, and I attended his camp in San Diego, which was a big eye-opener. I didn't know there was that many kids that played golf. Because we only had just a handful that did it at my town. And so it was an eye-awakening. And when I met Billy Casper, he was such an inspiration and a passion that he had for golf and teaching the kids. I go, gosh, that is so cool. And it just opened my eyes a lot in what it was. And when I got into college and came over, I visited to Spokane because my parents moved to Spokane where I was in college. That's where I kind of landed at a golf course up here and been here ever since. for the most part, but I've also traveled and been at other courses in Arizona. But the teaching part of it has always been something that's been really easy for me. I love to solve problems. I love to try to solve problems. And to solve golf, you know, it's never ending. So it's always a treat to kind of figure it out with someone else on their game. And I just gravitated to that a lot.
Why did you choose short game topics for your book?
It was obvious. Because yeah, that's the easiest part as a general overall. If they get what the short game is, they can actually make contact. It was kind of more of a book that I wanted to do that was for everybody, not just some particular caliber player. It was for understanding impact and understanding the short game and putting and chipping. And I've always been a good short game player, so it was an easy topic for me. But and we don't get to teach it that much, so it was kind of fun for me to say something about short game. Everybody always wants us to watch them do their full swing and their drive, and I'd much rather teach the short game. But when the client's, you know, struggling, trying to go, you know, get different direction, they're always wanting to do the longer stuff where their score can improve. And we, and as teachers, most of us would love to teach the short game a lot more than we do.
Chicks dig the long ball, Kathy.
I know.
What are some of the highlights that you maybe can remember or, you know, that you thought were pretty cool over your years of teaching?
Oh, man, I, you know, just the students and trying to create a relationship is really a really massive reward in my part. I just got some great friends through it, and I think the camaraderie and being with people has always been something that I cherish. And to do that for teaching and to get into their game and try to figure out some things, that's always been a highlight of mine.
Hey, I'll give you one more question. We'll let you get out here and get on with your day. But if we come to Eastern Washington, what are some of the courses we want to play around the Spokane area besides your place, Indian Canyon?
Well, Indian Canyon is a must-stop. It's always a tourist attraction to come into town. When you do come into town, there's like most of them will come to Indian Canyon. It's by the airport. It's got the view. It's a magnificent venue as far as that's concerned. They always go to Coeur d'Alene a lot and go to the Coeur d'Alene Resort. Another one is Circling Raven is another one. All of our golf courses are very very good as far as priced, and we're a very golf community. We have, oh, gosh, we have a lot of golf courses. All of our city and county courses are in amazing shapes, and the prices are, you know, they're under $30. It's just
wow.
People love to play golf up here.
Well, we've been talking with PGA teaching professional from Spokane, Washington, Kathy Gildersleeve Jensen. She has a published book out there, How to Play Golf Inside 50 Yards, which I'd recommend you can pick up on Amazon. Kathy, again, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us today.
Oh, my pleasure, Fred. I just really enjoyed talking to you, and I'm sure we'll do it again.
I look forward to it.
There you have it. That was our BIG, Kathy Gildersleeve Jensen, Director of Golf Instruction in Indian Canyon Golf Course in Spokane, Washington. She's the 2014 PGA Teacher of the Year. And that e-book that she has, you know, I would like to ask her if she has one for all over the course so that I can use it, because I really need it. So, but anyway, what a great thing. She was also a 2012 Pacific Northwest PGA Teacher of the Year, and that was, at that time, the PGA of America recognized her for effective use of technology and media in reaching golfers, both new and seasoned, and she has also guided more than 100 students to collegiate success. So what a career she's had, and what a great teacher she is.
Yeah, I've gotten to know Kathy a little bit through through social media, through Facebook, and a little bit on Twitter, and I've heard her on other shows, and have wanted to get with her for some time, and we were finally able to get it done. So, really, really great to get to talk to her, and hopefully we'll get to meet face to face someday.
And we thank her for that. So now we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to take the practice range, and we'll take a look, an in-depth look, at what Chambers Bay was this past weekend. Don't go away.
Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to visit www.edraft.com for analysis, breaking news, and more. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter at edraftsports and on Facebook at facebook.com/edraftsports. Don't forget to check out our co-hosts on Twitter by clicking their names in the episode description. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now it's time for the practice range. Every week, Fred and I pick a topic, and we take our shots at it. This week, what else, other than the U.S. Open, can we talk about? And it's something related to it, and it's the course. You know, like Fred mentioned and Kathy agreed, it has been the most talked about course in U.S. Open history. It was certainly a controversial championship with so many players complaining about the state of the Chambers Bay greens and the link-style course there on the Puget Sound. But for all the faults, particularly with the greens, the course really served up a memorable tournament that culminated in a thrilling finish featuring many of the world's best players. There can be no qualms about the course's ability to identify the most talented golfers. I mean, Rory McIlroy, number one in the world, was spot on when he said he thought it would separate the best from the rest. He set the tone for the final round with a charge up the leaderboard that had him flirting with the contention until he bogeyed the par 3 15. A former number one, Adam Scott took up the baton with a sizzling 64 to set a challenging clubhouse lead at 3 under par. Then came former Open champion Louis Oosthuizen with inward half of 29 to go one stroke better. None of this would have been possible had the course and its setup been too severe. Those charges preceded the dramatic denouement when Dustin Johnson missed that eagle to win as he three-putted to lose on the 72nd green. Yes, some of the greens were very poor. The fourth was particularly bad, with substantial bare sandy patches that had no grass at all. Most had a camouflage coloring and a pattern that couldn't hide considerable imperfections, yet the 13th and the 7th, both recently relayed, were excellent putting surfaces. The key to putting those greens was a positive stroke because anything that dribbled towards the hole would never hold its line. This suggests the U.S. Open maybe came too soon to a course that has only been open for 8 years. If the other greens had been receiving care and attention, lavish like the renewed surface, there would be fewer complaints. But let me tell you, the Black Knight, Garrett Player's criticism, I'm sorry, they were really over the top. Uncalled for. On the Golf Channel, player called, you know, who competed in the career Grand Slam by winning the U.S. Open 50 years ago, he let loose some pointed criticisms, particularly at architect Robert Trent Jones Jr. and his apparently tilted course. You know, stated that also that ordinary players couldn't enjoy such a course and that a 10 handicapper wouldn't break 100. But the biggest reservation that I would say was the layout that made it impossible for spectators to follow their favorite players for the whole 18 holes. That is inexcusable, really, in a sport where a big part of the magic is sharing not just the theater, but the stage with the players, and that's something the players relish. Overall, I don't think it was that too tough of a course. If you see, like Fred, you mentioned earlier, when Brent Snedeker, Louis Oosthuizen, even Dustin Johnson, Rory McIlroy, Adam Scott, they played aggressive, they conquered the course. I think it was more mentally than what really the course brought, but really a great spectacle. At the end, what I can say is that, you know, golf historians quite rightly will look at the champion it produced because Spieth has definitely graduated to superstar status in the blink of an eye for it.
Yeah, much was written, much will be written and talked about in the future. But please understand, Chambers Bay is a beautiful property. I urge anyone, any golfer, if they have the chance to go to Tacoma and view the golf course and play it. I think it's about $300 to play it, so it's a little steep. But it's right there with the Pebble Beaches of the world and the Pinehurst and all these places. It's just golf. There's no other resort there. There's nothing going. They're talking about maybe building another course and making a destination with some lodging alternatives and things, but that's not done yet. But it's a great property. So, Carlos, the points I want to make here real quick, because I know we're starting to run out of time, but the final four holes, 15, 16, 17, 18, just lend themselves to fantastic finishes. A three-shot lead entering the last four holes would not have been safe no matter what. Spieth ended up with a couple-shot lead and gave him away with a double bogey at 17. That's possible. The other is possible also where you could go birdie on the par 3 15th, eagle or birdie at 16 because of the drivable par 4, birdie at 17, and eagle at 18. You could go 5 under or even 6 under on the last four holes of that golf course. It's possible. It can be done. So that could be a huge swing. And so for that reason, I really think the USGA will be back there. Yes, Chambers Bay needs to have a few changes. It was not spectator-friendly. Golfers don't want to go to a golf tournament and sit in the stands and just watch what they can see. The elevations are such that if you're up in those stands or you're up on that ridge, you can see a lot of the golf course, especially if you have binoculars. But that's not what they want to do. Golfers want to get out there, and they want to get up close to the players. The other thing, we addressed it earlier, but, you know, Poulter and Billy Horschel's comments, you got to take those from a couple guys who struggled and didn't play well and, you know, are used to the finer golf courses that they go to. I take those with a grain of sand. Gary Players, I talked about that earlier. That was just, you know, he was out of line with that. He needs to apologize to USGA. There was no sense in that. This was big. This was really big for the Pacific Northwest. First time the U.S. Open has ever gone out there. As we documented last week on the show, $140 million economic impact to the Pacific Northwest, Seattle-Tacoma area specifically. Social media was all over it, this whole thing. You know, it was really kind of fun to follow some of the tweets and the comments on Facebook. I was reading some to my wife. She was laughing out loud from some of them. I have to mention this. The tweet of the week of the tournament goes to Pam Turner. She's at Pam10VA. And it says that Fred Flintstone called. He wants his gravel pit back. Hashtag Chambers Bay Golf Course, hashtag U.S. Open 2015. I loved that. I absolutely loved it. Someone referred to the greens to broccoli, and this quote is broccoli. They're not that green. More like cauliflower, hashtag U.S. Open. So people were having fun with it. They were imaginative. But this whole thing about the Chambers Bay, don't knock the golf course because it's a beautiful property, and I urge everyone to get out there and try to play it. The USGA just went way overboard in this thing, and they've done it before. It didn't have to be that hard. It didn't have to be that fast. It didn't have to be that severe. They'll figure it out the next time. They'll learn. Hopefully they'll get a little bit better. But the Blue Blazer, khaki pants guys, they kind of like to control things, and they just went a little bit too far on this one.
But we had a great, great, great tournament, and it's Jordan Spieth halfway to the true Grand Slam. Hey, Fred, we still have some buffer after the hour, so if you want to get your final thoughts in, feel free to do it.
Real quick, Golden State Warriors are going to go to Augusta. Normally here, the players are after a big championship. We're going to a Disneyland. Well, Andre Iguodala, the NBA Finals MVP, was yelling, "We're going to Augusta." The Warrior coach, Stephen Kerr, promises players a trip to famed Augusta if they won the championship, and by golly, they did. A 6-year-old boy raised $25,000 for pediatric cancer in memory of his kindergarten classmate Danny Nickerson in Foxborough, Massachusetts last week by playing 100 holes of golf. He was inspired with the idea from his mother, who's a program director for Golf Fights Cancer, a nonprofit that encourages golfers to play and raise money for cancer-related charities. Good all for him. That is fantastic. Golf is a sport that more adults play. Even though you've had hip replacements, knee surgeries, you can still play. You can ride a cart. If you want to walk, you can log up to 6-7 miles in a round of golf. So that's good. And one more thing, real quick. Announced today, Jeff Shackelford on his website, going to be a new course at the Greenbrier. It's going to be a Jack Nicklaus, Gary Player, and Lee Trevino collaboration there. So Jim Justice is spending more money at the Greenbrier.
That's great news. That's great news. Hey, you know, I have a couple of final thoughts here. And you were referring about golfers being, you know, the devil and playing that. I remember Hugo Chavez, the late president from Venezuela, calling the oligarchs that play golf the devil. So anyway, talking about that, I understand there's a more serious international incident brewing there in Venezuela. Apparently, the Swiss ambassador's residence is adjacent to the Caracas Country Club third hole. As to many golf course neighbors, Ambassador Sabine Allman is none too pleased with errant shots that make their way into her yard. However, she has determined to play a card not available to the typical recipient of incoming titleists. As a diplomat, the ambassador has invoked the 1961 Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, which states the private residence of a diplomatic agent shall enjoy the same inviolability and protection as the premises of the mission. Thus, the ambassador has posted a sign proclaiming launching balls into this residence is a danger to whoever is within Swiss territory and a violation of the Vienna Convention if a golf ball injures or kills anyone on Swiss soil. You know, my little island is just about an hour flight from Venezuela, so I'm urging everybody here right now to go to the United Nations and talk to the Security Council to get involved in the best interest of preventing the Third World War. You know, so slicers, beware with your shots. Don't get them there. And, you know, just to finish up, there's golf. A golf course is an unlikely place to start a revolution. Nonetheless, that's where opening shots of a new battle for Spain's cities have just been fired. Madrid's club, Campo de Villa de Madrid, is arguably Spain's most exclusive golf club, a high society meeting place. And, you know, new Madrid's major left-winger Manuela Carmena wants to tear down the fence surrounding the club and let the public come in. If she gets her way, the club's two swimming pools would become accessible to the public, restaurants would be converted to a hospitality academy, and the golf courses would take a new life as a farm school. You know, this is just the start of a big and lengthy fight, but I now urge golf's most interesting man, Miguel Angel Jimenez, Sergio Garcia, all the Spanish golfers, to join forces and threaten to start shooting errant golf balls into the major's office if she continues with such an idiotic plan. So please, let's start doing this. Anyway, Back Niners, that wraps up another week of the Back Nine Report presented by eDraft.com. It was our pleasure to bring you the latest on the world of golf. Thank you for listening to us the past hour. Special thanks to our VIG, very important guest of the week, is Kathy Gildersleeve Jensen. Don't forget to join us again next Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time here on Block Talk Radio, and also through TuneIn or download our show on iTunes. If you haven't done so, follow the show on Twitter. Our ID is at Back Nine Report. My name is Carlos Torres. Along with Fred Alvader, we wish you to be happy, be blessed, and enjoy the great game of golf. Happy golfing, everybody.
Good night, everybody.